Welcome to the History Maps podcast.
Today, we are conducting a deep dive into Confucianism, and this is part of our broader Chinese history series.
Right. And our mission today is to really unpack this foundational framework.
Exactly. We need to understand how, you know, a single philosopher from ancient China constructed an ethical and social system that didn't just survive his own era, but actually became the political and cultural bedrock of East Asia for over two millennia.
And to do this, we are drawing on a really comprehensive text base. We're pulling from encyclopedic overviews of Chinese philosophy, historical biographies detailing the life of Confucius himself.
And we also have structural analyses of the Chinese educational and imperial examination systems.
Yeah, plus direct translations of core teaching texts, specifically the Analects and the Five Classics.
And we are going to distill this vast tradition into clear, actionable insights for you.
Right, because whether you are navigating a complex hierarchy at your workplace, or maybe trying to figure out how to raise a family with a sense of moral obligation.
Or honestly, simply attempting to be a decent person in a chaotic society.
Exactly. This exploration is highly relevant. It is fundamentally a study in how personal, individual ethics can scale up to govern entire empires.
The scale of that influence is really what makes this so critical to understand. I mean, we are tracing the intellectual architecture of billions of lives across centuries.
Yeah.
But to understand the architecture, we have to look at the soil it was built on.
Right. Because a system that becomes utterly obsessed with order, with proper conduct, with deeply codified hierarchy, it doesn't just emerge from a peaceful society.
No, not at all. It is born from a period of profound disorder. The environmental pressures essentially forge the philosophy.
So we have to rewind the clock to ancient China. Specifically, we're focusing on the decline of the Zhou dynasty.
That historical context is where we must begin. Around the year 1046 BCE.
1046, okay.
Yeah, so this is the era when the early Zhou dynasty established its power right after overthrowing the preceding Shang dynasty. And to govern a massive expanse of territory without modern communication or, you know, infrastructure, the early Zhou kings relied on a system known as Fengjin.
Let's establish the mechanics of Fengjin for a second. This was essentially a decentralized feudal system, right?
That's right.
The Zhou king, sitting in the central capital, just could not micromanage every single province. So he distributed land, titles, and authority to his kin, his loyal allies, and his military commanders.
It was a vast, interconnected network of hereditary territories. The central authority relied entirely on these regional lords.
And what were the lords doing in return?
Well, the lords managed their specific lands, and in return, they owed the king tribute. And military service when called upon, and of course, absolute loyalty.
Right. And this system wasn't held together just by the threat of military force, was it?
No, and that's key. It was held together by deep bonds of a shared ritual culture. The Duke of Zhou, who was a regent early in the dynasty, and who later became a highly revered figure, by the way, he was instrumental in codifying these rituals and administrative principles.
So it was a society bound by strict protocols, moderation, and a sense of shared moral obligation to the central king.
Exactly.
Let's try to visualize how this works, and honestly, more importantly, how it fails. I mean, think of the early Zhou dynasty like a massive corporate restructuring.
Oh, that's an interesting way to frame it.
Right, so the central Zhou king is the central headquarters. HQ has the massive pull of authority, legitimacy, and the ultimate say. The regional lords are the branch managers, operating smoothly under that central authority.
Right. Everything is orderly.
For centuries, the system functions beautifully. But then, the central headquarters begins to lose its authority. The central Zhou kings become weaker, less competent, and less capable of enforcing their will.
The gravitational pull just weakens. And as the central authority fractures, the regional branch managers, those lords, realize they are no longer bound to the center.
They start looking at their neighbors not as fellow colleagues of the Zhou, but as targets for aggressive, hostile takeovers.
Yeah, they start warring with each other. Fast forward several centuries to what historians call the Spring and Autumn period, which then bleeds into the Warring States period.
Things get really bad here.
Completely. The regional lords stopped listening to the king entirely. The societal shift was just catastrophic.
The traditional values, those shared rituals you mentioned, all abandoned.
Everything that had bound the Zhou aristocracy together for generations was gone. It shifted into an era of relentless realpolitik.
Just raw power.
Exactly.
Yeah.
States were solely focused on survival, expansion, and coercion. Assassination became a totally standard political tool.
Which is terrifying.
Deception was prized over honor. We see constant grinding warfare among local lords, bringing immense suffering to the common populations who are being drafted into these endless regional conflicts.
It's a society tearing itself apart from the inside.
Right.
It's shifting from a civilization based on ritual to one based purely on violence and leverage.
And it is exactly in this environment, you know, this period of perceived moral and political collapse, that Confucius is born.
So let's talk about the man himself.
Right. His birth name was Kangqiu. He was born in the year 551 BCE.
And this was in the state of Lu, correct?
Yes, the state of Lu, which corresponds to modern-day Kufu in the Shandong province. And his origins are really vital to understanding his later worldview.
The sources detail a very specific lineage for him. His father, Kang He, was an elderly military commandant.
Kang. He had a primary wife and concubines, but he lacked a healthy son to carry on his lineage. And in that culture, that was a matter of deep importance.
So what did he do?
Given his advanced age, he took a much younger concubine from a neighboring region called Zhu.
Okay, I see.
This union produced the child who would become Confucius.
But the father died when Confucius was only 3 years old, right?
He did.
So he didn't grow up in some wealthy palatial estate with tutors and servants. The death of his father left him to be raised in relative poverty by his mother.
That background of modest means shaped him deeply. He had these distant aristocratic roots that could be traced back to the Shang dynasty, but his lived reality was just one of hardship.
He had to work his way up.
He really did. He had to educate himself in the classical texts, in ancient rituals, and in music. He took on very practical, minor administrative jobs in the state of Lu just to survive.
The records show that by the time he was in his 20s and 30s, he was managing state granaries and keeping livestock.
Yeah, he was essentially a working-class bureaucrat.
But his self-education and his clear capability eventually led to a rise in status.
It did. By the time he was 50, he had climbed the political ladder to become a minister of justice in the state of Lu.
So he finally had a seat at the table where decisions were actually made.
He did, yet the reality of political power deeply disillusioned him.
Why is that?
Well, around the year 500 BCE, he witnessed the sheer corruption of the Lu court firsthand. He saw righteous ministers marginalized or even executed.
Just totally sidelined.
Yeah. He saw warlords acting with total impunity, ignoring any semblance of law or ethical conduct. He realized that the rulers were not interested in justice at all.
They were just interested in consolidating power through whatever means necessary.
Precisely. So he resigned.
He just walked away from the prestige and the security of his position.
He did. And that resignation initiates a 14-year period of wandering. This is often called his exile.
So what did he do during this time? Did he just travel alone?
He traveled with a small, dedicated retinue of disciples. They moved through various states, Qi, Song, Chen, Kai.
He was essentially a political consultant, right? Traveling from court to court.
That's a good way to put it. He was actively seeking a ruler who would listen to him. He was looking for a leader who would adopt his vision of moral governance.
A system based on virtue and ethical leadership, rather than violence, heavy taxation, and coercion.
Exactly. But the reception he received was bleak. To say the least.
I could imagine. These warlords were fighting for their lives.
Right. The warlords of the spring and autumn period were locked in existential struggles for survival. When Confucius secured an audience, these rulers wanted military strategies.
They wanted logistical advice, how to raise larger armies, how to conquer neighboring territory, how to suppress peasant revolts.
Yes. And instead, Confucius would lecture them on ancient rituals, morality, and the necessity of ruling with benevolence.
It was a profound mismatch of priorities.
Completely. The rulers saw his ideas as quaint, maybe noble, but entirely useless for the brutal reality of their political landscape.
And during these 14 years, Confucius and his disciples faced extreme hardship, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. The historical accounts describe periods where they were surrounded by hostile forces, starved, mocked by hermits who thought Confucius was a fool for trying to save a doomed world, and repeatedly chased out of towns.
He found zero political success. He never found his philosopher king.
He really didn't. Eventually, exhausted and aging, he returned to his home state of Lulo around the year 484 BCE.
And he spent his final years teaching his disciples and editing classical texts, until his death in 479 BCE.
Right. To understand the philosophy he was trying to sell to those warlords, though, we have to understand how he viewed his own role in history.
Okay, let's get into that.
Confucius explicitly stated that he was not an innovator. He didn't claim to be a prophet receiving divine revelation, nor did he claim to be inventing a novel political theory out of thin air.
He viewed himself strictly as a transmitter.
Yes.
But a transmitter of what exactly?
A transmitter of the lost, perfect moral order of antiquity. He looked backward to go forward.
He believed that the ancient Xia, Shang, and specifically the early Western Zhou dynasties represented a golden age.
Exactly. He believed that the ancient sage kings had already discovered the blueprint for a utopian society, and humanity had simply degraded and lost its way over time.
So he was trying to reanimate ancient values and apply them as the cure for the chaos of his present day.
He was. But since he failed to find a ruler to implement this cure from the top down, the focus of his teaching had to shift.
Right. If you cannot fix the state by converting the king, you have to fix society from the inside out.
You have to start with the individual citizen.
This shift in focus is the foundation of Confucianism as we know it.
The ethical framework he developed is built on the premise that a harmonious society is just a collection of harmonious individuals. The focus becomes rigorous, lifelong, internal cultivation.
The sources outline this core architecture of virtue pretty clearly.
They do. During the Han Dynasty, centuries after his death, scholars categorized the core virtues Confucius spoke about into what we call the five constants, or the Wu Cheng.
Let's examine these, because they really are the raw materials of the entire philosophy. The first and the absolute highest of these virtues is Ren.
Ren. We typically translate this as benevolence or humaneness.
It's the pinnacle.
It is the defining characteristic of a moral human being. But benevolence in the Confucian sense is not just a passive feeling of goodwill.
No, it's active.
It is the active capacity for altruism and empathy. It requires the constant, difficult work of overcoming selfish, individualistic impulses.
Confucius argued that Ren is an innate potential within humans, but it requires deliberate practice to realize.
Right. Yes. It is the ability to see the humanity in another person and act accordingly, putting their well-being on par with your own.
So Ren is the feeling, the internal disposition of empathy.
Right.
The second constant is Yi, which translates to righteousness or justice. If Ren is the engine, Yi is the steering wheel.
That's a great analogy. Yi is the moral vision that allows an individual to make correct choices. It is the faculty of judgment.
And in the chaotic world Confucius lived in, rulers and citizens alike were driven by what was profitable or expedient.
Exactly. Yi is the deliberate prioritization of moral duty over personal profit. It is doing the right thing specifically because it is the right thing, even when it costs you something.
It is resolute adherence to principle. Now, the third constant is where modern readers often hit a wall.
Yes.
We translate Li as propriety or ritual. The texts describe Li as encompassing external forms, social decorum, ceremonies, and everyday etiquette.
Yes. Li governs how we interact in society, from grand state ceremonies all the way down to how you greet an elder or serve tea.
Okay, let's unpack this, because I can hear the modern friction point clearly.
I'm sure you can.
Ren and Yi make perfect sense to a contemporary mind. Benevolence and righteousness are universally respected. But Li, ritual and etiquette. To a lot of people today, this sounds like empty formalism.
It does.
It sounds like being overly concerned with which fork to use at a fancy dinner or making sure you bow at the exact correct angle. It can seem like superficial politeness that has nothing to do with deep morality.
It is a frequent modern critique, and it's often rooted in a society that values authentic internal feeling over external formality. But dismissing Li misses the profound psychological mechanism of Confucianism.
How so?
Well, the philosophy acknowledges that Li without Renso, performing rituals without genuine benevolence in your heart, is entirely empty. Confucius himself despised hypocrites who performed elaborate ceremonies but lacked empathy.
But the reverse is also true, isn't it?
Precisely. Ren without Li lacks a mechanism for societal expression. You can have a heart overflowing with benevolence and empathy, but without a shared vocabulary of behavior, without rules of engagement, you do not know how to manifest that benevolence in a way that society understands.
Think of it like music.
Oh, I like that.
Ren is the raw musical talent, the deep emotion you want to express. But Li is the sheet music and the instrument.
Right.
If you just have raw emotion without an instrument or the discipline to play notes, you just make noise. Li provides the structure that channels human emotion into a socially productive form so others can actually hear the melody.
That is a highly accurate way to frame it. Li prevents societal chaos by prescribing how we should respond to one another in highly specific contexts. It lubricates social interactions.
And the texts support this connection directly.
They do. The Analects in Book 3, Verse 17 captures this interdependence perfectly. Confucius says, if I am not enlightened in benevolence, how can I observe the rites?
The inner virtue of Ren must animate the outer form of Li, and the outer form of Li gives shape to the inner virtue of Ren. They are inseparable.
The forms are the vehicle for the virtue.
And to complete the five constants, we have Zi, which is wisdom or discerning judgment.
Right, Zi. This is the intellectual capacity to perceive right from wrong, to understand the consequences of actions, and to judge the character of others accurately.
And finally, Jin, which translates to sincerity, faithfulness, or trustworthiness.
Zin is the bedrock of social reliance. It means your words align with your actions. You are reliable in your commitments and unwaveringly devoted to your principles.
Because if a society lacks Jin, if no one can trust the word of anyone else, the entire social fabric disintegrates.
Which is exactly what Confucius saw happening in the Warring States period.
It is vital to note the emphasis the sources place on how these virtues are acquired. They are not divine commandments handed down by a wrathful deity on a mountaintop.
No, they were innate human potentials, but they are like muscles. If you do not exercise them daily, they atrophy. The entire system relies on rigorous, lifelong self-cultivation.
And if these five constants are the tools of self-cultivation, the finished product is the ideal human being. We move from the abstract virtues to the person who actually embodies them in daily life.
And Confucius called this person the Junzi.
The evolution of this term, Junzi, represents a massive paradigm shift in Chinese thought. Let's look at the etymology.
Yeah, let's.
The word literally translates to son of a lord or prince's son.
Prior to the teachings of Confucius, Junzi was a purely hereditary term. It designated a member of the aristocracy. You are a Junzi simply because of your bloodline, regardless of your character.
You just won the genetic lottery.
Basically, yes.
But Confucius takes this deeply entrenched class term and radically redefines it. He shifts the meaning entirely away from aristocrat by birth to an ethical aristocrat by merit.
He argued that true nobility had absolutely nothing to do with who your father was. It was entirely based on moral character.
It was a shockingly democratic idea to introduce into a highly stratified feudal society.
It really was. He was telling commoners that they could achieve a status higher than the warlords ruling over them simply by disciplining their minds and actions.
To make this relatable, think about the evolution of the English word gentleman.
Okay.
Centuries ago in Europe, a gentleman was a literal landowner. It was a strict social class. You had a coat of arms, you owned an estate, you were a gentleman.
Right, it's as formal.
But over time, the culture shifts the definition. Today, if you describe someone as a true gentleman, you are not talking about their real estate portfolio or their pedigree.
No, you mean they treat people with profound respect, they hold doors, they speak with integrity. It describes their character.
Exactly. Confucius executed that exact same linguistic pivot with the word Junzi over 2,000 years ago.
And the texts give us very specific behavioral markers for a Junzi. They are not just nice people, they operate with extreme discipline.
Give us an example.
For example, in the Analects, Book 4, verse 24, Confucius says, "The Junzi wishes to be slow of speech and quick in action."
They do not boast. They do not make empty promises. They are deliberate with their words, but when a moral action is required, they move decisively.
The intentionality of the Junzi is perhaps their most defining trait. There is a profound metaphor used in Analects Book 15, verse 7.
Let's hear it.
Confucius is praising the character of a specific historical figure, and he says, "When the Tao prevails in the state, he is like an arrow. When the Tao does not prevail, he is like an arrow."
Notice the mechanism of the arrow there. Why does he use an arrow to describe a person?
What's fascinating here is that the arrow represents unyielding direction and internal momentum. An arrow, once fired, does not change its course based on the wind or the environment. It flies straight toward the target.
Right.
What Confucius is saying is that the Junzi is not reactive to their environment. When the Tao prevails, meaning when the government is just, society is peaceful, and morality is rewarded, the Junzi acts virtuously.
But crucially, when the Tao does not prevail.
When the government is completely corrupt, when warlords are slaughtering the innocent, when society is falling apart, the Junzi does not compromise their morals to fit in. They remain straight and true to their ethical target.
Their moral direction is generated internally, not dictated by external circumstances. They refuse to let a corrupted world corrupt them.
Exactly. And Confucius frequently contrasts the Junzi with the opposite archetype, which he calls the small man or the petty person.
Right. In Analects 4:16, he states, "The Junzi comprehends according to right, the small man comprehends according to profit."
The small man is fundamentally transactional. Every interaction is evaluated based on what they can extract from it.
But the Junzi evaluates every interaction based on what moral duty requires of them.
This focus on internal cultivation is essential, but it is only half of the equation. A Junzi does not cultivate these virtues so they can retreat to a mountaintop and meditate in pure isolation.
Because Confucianism is an applied philosophy.
It is. It only activates when people interact. The virtue of a Junzi is entirely measured by how they navigate the web of society.
Which brings us to the social map Confucius drew. The individual must be connected to others, and the outline for this connection is found in the five relationships, or the Wulun.
These are the fundamental bonds that structure all of society. The texts define these five bonds as ruler and subject, father and son, husband and wife, elder brother and younger brother, and friend and friend.
This is where we need to pause and examine the mechanics carefully, because modern listeners will immediately flag a massive issue here.
I'm sure they will.
When you list those relationships, ruler over subject, father over son, husband over wife, elder brother over younger, it sounds incredibly rigid. To a contemporary mind, this sounds like a blueprint for absolute authoritarianism.
It does.
It sounds like a system designed solely to demand blind obedience from the inferior party to the superior party.
That is the most persistent criticism of Confucianism, and looking strictly at the surface hierarchy, it is an understandable reading. But to understand how the system was designed to function, we have to look at the mechanism that prevents it from simply being tyranny.
And what is that mechanism?
That mechanism is reciprocity.
Reciprocity.
The two-way street.
Exactly. The relationships are undeniably hierarchical. Confucianism does not believe in a flat, egalitarian society. It believes hierarchy is a natural fact of human existence.
Okay.
The inferior party in the relationship absolutely owes deference, loyalty, and respect to the superior party. But the superior party has an equally binding, incredibly demanding obligation to the inferior party.
The secure owes benevolence, protection, care, and moral guidance. Yes. The ruler must be just. The father must be nurturing. The husband must be supportive.
The hierarchy is a structure for mutual obligation, not just a ladder for power. So what happens if the superior party fails? What if the ruler is a tyrant or the father is abusive? Does the subject still owe blind obedience?
This is where the philosophy has teeth. If a ruler is tyrannical, they are violating the fundamental nature of the relationship. They are failing in their duty of benevolence.
And later Confucian philosophers expanded on this, right?
Yes, particularly Mencius, who lived from 372 to 289 BCE. He expanded on this concept radically. Mencius argued that if a ruler fails to act with benevolence and brutalizes his people, he essentially ceases to be a true ruler.
He becomes a mere tyrant, a criminal.
Exactly. And in that scenario, the subjects are not only freed from their obligation of loyalty, they are morally justified in overthrowing him. The hierarchy is only legitimate if the superior party performs their moral duty.
The superior's authority is conditional on their virtue. And the bedrock of all these societal relationships, the training ground for this complex system of mutual obligation, is found in the concept of xiao, or filial piety.
Filial piety is the cornerstone of Confucian social ethics. It is the bond between parent and child.
And it goes far beyond the basic expectation of providing food and shelter for your aging parents.
Far beyond. It demands a deep internal respect, a sense of profound gratitude for the gift of life, and a lifelong commitment to carrying on the family's moral legacy.
It even extends beyond the living, encompassing the proper performance of burial rituals and the veneration of ancestors.
The sources highlight how Mencius explained the functional importance of filial piety. It is not just about keeping peace in the house. The family is the laboratory where human empathy is first cultivated.
That is the vital insight. A human being is not born knowing how to interact with an empire. They are born into a family.
Exactly. A child learns to love and respect their parents and learns how to navigate the dynamics with their older siblings. Once that empathy and understanding of reciprocal duty are established in the home, the individual can then extend it outward.
The process scales up. You treat the elders of your community with the respect you learn to give your parents. You serve your ruler with the loyalty you learn to give your father.
It builds outward.
Let's construct a vignette to see how this scales. Picture a household operating under these principles. The father manages the family's affairs justly, ensuring everyone is provided for and educated. He acts with genuine benevolence.
And the children, in turn, show him deep respect, following his guidance.
Right. When the grandparents pass away, the children perform the complex burial rites with genuine mourning, maintaining the ancestral shrine.
This is not just a picture of domestic bliss, though. In the Confucian view, this single household is a microcosm of the state.
If you can create thousands of households functioning with this kind of reciprocal harmony, the entire empire will naturally become stable and prosperous.
Yeah.
You will not need a massive police force or draconian laws because the citizens have already been trained in moral duty within their own homes.
The family is the basic unit of political order. A harmonious state is impossible without harmonious families.
And the philosophy does not stop at the borders of the state.
Yeah.
If the family is a microcosm of the state is a microcosm of the entire cosmos.
We have to examine how Confucius viewed the universe and the natural order.
Right, because we have scaled up from the internal virtues of the individual to the structure of the family to the administration of the state, and now we are looking at the cosmic order. The core concept here is Tian, which is generally translated as heaven.
It is.
But if my Western brain immediately jumps to the idea of a king with a white beard sitting in the clouds handing down laws, I am fundamentally misunderstanding the concept, right?
You would be misinterpreting it entirely. It is a critical distinction to make. Unlike the Abrahamic faiths, classical Confucianism does not posit an anthropomorphic creator deity.
So no god with a human-like personality.
No, there is no god with a human-like personality who demands worship, listens to individual prayers, or intervenes directly in the daily affairs of humanity to punish or reward specific actions.
So if Tian is not a divine king in the clouds, what is it? It seems less like a deity and more like a physical law, like gravity.
Gravity is an excellent comparison. Tian is viewed as an impersonal, self-regulating cosmic force. It is the natural moral order of the universe.
I see.
It sets the patterns of the seasons, the cycles of life and death, and it establishes the fundamental moral laws of human existence. There is no need for a divine revelation or a burning bush because the will of heaven is evident in the natural harmony of the world.
Analects 1719 captures this perfectly. Confucius says, "Does heaven speak? Yet the four seasons run their course and all things are produced."
Heaven does not need to speak. It operates.
And this concept of Tian is not just abstract theology. It is directly tied to the raw mechanics of political power through a concept called the Mandate of Heaven, or Tianming.
The Mandate of Heaven is one of the most brilliant and enduring political doctrines in human history. It traces its origins back to the early Zhou dynasty.
Right. Remember, the Zhou overthrew the preceding Shang dynasty. They needed a justification for this violent regime change.
Because if the Shang kings were appointed by divine right, overthrowing them would be the ultimate sacrilege. The Zhou needed a legal and theological loophole to justify their conquest.
Exactly. So the Zhou propagandists developed the idea that heaven, this natural moral order, grants the right to rule based entirely on ethical performance, not on divine bloodlines.
If a ruler is virtuous, if he cares for the people and maintains harmony, heaven blesses his reign with good harvests, stable weather, and peace. He possesses the mandate.
But if a ruler becomes tyrannical, corrupt, and neglects the people, heaven withdraws the mandate.
It is a cosmic performance review.
But how do the people know the mandate has been withdrawn? Heaven doesn't send an email.
Heaven communicates through the natural world. Natural disasters, massive floods, catastrophic famines, earthquakes, and ultimately widespread peasant rebellions were interpreted not just as bad luck, but as cosmic signs that the ruler had lost heaven's favor.
The natural order was reflecting the moral disorder of the court.
Exactly. This withdrawal of the mandate mathematically legitimized a new dynasty to rise up, overthrow the corrupt ruler, and restore order.
It creates a fascinating feedback loop between human morality and the natural environment. The state of the empire reflects the state of the cosmos.
It does.
But this brings up a crucial question regarding the supernatural. Here's where it gets really interesting. We're talking about cosmic forces, but Chinese culture at the time had a massive, rich tradition of animism, spirit worship, and deeply held beliefs in the afterlife. Where does Confucius fit into the supernatural?
He maintained a very pragmatic, almost agnostic distance from mysticism and the supernatural.
So he didn't believe in it.
Well, he didn't outright deny the existence of spirits or ghosts, but he firmly believed that human beings should focus their energy entirely on the human world.
When you read the sources, this is a recurring theme. His disciples were clearly curious about the afterlife and spirits, but he constantly redirected them back to the present.
Yes. In Analects 6:22, he says, "Respect the ghosts and spirits, but keep them at a distance. This may be called wisdom."
And in Analects 11:12, a disciple explicitly asks him how to serve the spirits of the dead. Confucius replies, You are not yet able to serve people. How could you be able to serve ghosts and spirits?
Notice the mechanism there. He refuses to indulge in theological speculation when there is immediate suffering and disorder in the human realm. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it reveals that Confucius valued religious ceremonies for their social utility, not their supernatural efficacy.
When families performed elaborate sacrifices to their ancestors, offering food and burning incense, what was the point if Confucius was keeping the spirits at a distance?
He instructed his followers to perform the sacrifices as if present.
As if present. So it fundamentally doesn't matter if the spirit of the ancestor is literally hovering in the room, physically consuming the smoke of the incense.
It doesn't matter at all. What matters is the psychological and social effect of the ritual on the living people performing it.
Gathering the extended family, preparing the offerings together, performing the rites with deep reverence and solemnity, this reinforces filial piety.
It bonds the community together. It channels the grief of loss into a highly structured, productive format. The focus is always on the ethical ordering of this world right now. It is a profoundly humanistic approach to religion.
So we have explored this incredible, comprehensive system of thought, a system covering personal virtue, family dynamics, state governance, and the cosmic order.
We have.
But historically speaking, as we noted earlier, Confucius died in 479 BCE feeling like a complete failure. He spent his life wandering, he never found a ruler to implement his ideas, and society remained in chaos. Yet, fast forward, and his ideas eventually conquered the largest empire on Earth. We have to look at the institutionalization of this philosophy. How did these teachings survive the Warring States period and become the bedrock of state orthodoxy?
The survival of Confucianism is a direct testament to the fierce dedication of his disciples and the enduring power of the texts they compiled and preserved. We have to examine the Confucian canon.
The collection of literature that eventually became the foundational curriculum for Chinese civilization for two millennia.
Yes. The sources divide the core texts into two main groups, the five classics, or Wujing, and the four books, or Sishu. Let's break down the mechanics of these texts, starting with the five classics.
These are older, pre-existing texts that Confucius is traditionally said to have edited, compiled, and used as his teaching materials.
First, there's the I Ching, or the Book of Changes.
I've heard of that one.
Originally, this was an ancient divination manual involving casting yarrow stalks. But it evolved into a profound philosophical text about the balance of yin and yang, the dynamic, ever-changing nature of the cosmos, and how a wise person anticipates and adapts to those changes.
Then there's the classic of poetry. This is an anthology of hundreds of ancient poems, hymns, and folk songs.
Why would poetry be a core political text, though?
Because it was used as a tool for emotional education. It trained students in human feelings, social norms, and mutual responsiveness. In diplomatic meetings, officials would quote specific poems to convey subtle political messages or critique a ruler without causing a direct loss of face.
It was incredibly practical. Next is the Book of Documents. This is a compilation of historical speeches, proclamations, and political visions attributed to the ancient sage kings.
It provided the historical precedent for humane government and the mandate of heaven. It proved that the utopian past Confucius talked about was documented fact.
We also have the Book of Rites. This is an exhaustive text that details the social forms, the court administration, and the ceremonial etiquette of the Zhou dynasty.
This is where the concept of the rituals and propriety we discussed earlier is heavily codified, outlining exactly how a person should behave in any given social situation.
And finally, the Spring and Autumn Annals. On the surface, this is just a very sparse, dry, historical chronicle of events in Confucius's home state of Lume.
However, Confucians believe that Confucius purposefully chose specific words and omitted others when editing this text to pass subtle, profound moral judgments on the rulers and events being described.
Setting it was an exercise in learning moral discernment.
So those five classics are the older foundational texts. But centuries later, during the Song Dynasty, a highly influential Neo-Confucian scholar named Zhu Xi elevated a second set of texts to primary importance, the four books.
These texts focus much more directly on Confucius himself and his immediate philosophical successors. The four books became the gateway to the philosophy.
They include the Analects, which we have been quoting, the collection of sayings, brief dialogues, and anecdotes featuring Confucius and his students.
Then there is the Mencius, detailing the dialogues of his most famous successor, who, as we mentioned, argued for the innate goodness of human nature and the right to overthrow tyrants.
And the final two books are actually specific chapters pulled from the older Book of Rites, we have the doctrine of the mean, which explores the psychological state of perfect balance, avoiding extremes to maintain cosmic harmony.
And the great learning, which outlines a very specific step-by-step political philosophy, showing how personal self-cultivation in the mind eventually leads outward to world peace.
But it is crucial to remember that these texts, particularly the Analects, would not exist without the disciples who memorized the oral teachings, recorded them, and passed them down.
Absolutely. The sources highlight several key figures in this transmission. There was Yan Hui, who was Confucius's absolute favorite student.
Right, he lived in extreme poverty, but he possessed a brilliant mind and perfectly embodied the virtue of Ran. He tragically died young, which devastated Confucius.
You also have figures like Zilu, who provides a great contrast. He was essentially the bold warrior of the group.
He was known for his brash courage, his intense loyalty, and his tendency to act before thinking, which Confucius frequently had to temper.
And then there is Zigong, a highly skilled diplomat and successful merchant who helped spread Confucian ideas through his vast political and commercial connections across different states.
Yet, despite the efforts of these disciples, Confucianism remained just one of many competing philosophies during the chaotic Warring States period.
It was competing with Taoism, with Mohism, and most dangerously, with legalism. In fact, Confucianism was nearly eradicated.
Really?
When the Qin dynasty finally conquered all the Warring States and unified China around 221 BCE, they didn't adopt Confucianism, they adopted legalism.
Let's contrast legalism with Confucianism, because this conflict defines the future of the empire. If Confucianism is the belief that you can teach the cattle to want to stay in the pasture through moral cultivation, legalism is the belief that you just need highly electrified fences and cattle prods.
That's a vivid way to put it. Legalism argued that human nature is inherently selfish and evil. The only way to govern is through draconian laws, absolute state power, and severe, terrifying punishments for even minor infractions.
The Qin dynasty under legalism was ruthlessly efficient but completely devoid of empathy. They actively suppressed Confucianism.
They saw philosophers debating ancient rituals and moral constraints on the emperor as a direct threat to state power. The Qin executed hundreds of Confucian scholars and systematically burned the classical texts we just discussed.
But the Qin dynasty's brutal approach backfired. They built the Great Wall and unified the script, but they ruled with such terrifying cruelty that the moment the first emperor died, the entire empire exploded in rebellion.
The Qin dynasty collapsed after only 15 years. Legalism literally tore the state apart from the inside.
And when the dust settled and the Han dynasty took over, everything changed.
The Han rulers realized that you can conquer an empire from horseback using legalist violence, but you cannot govern an empire from horseback.
You need a system that promotes stability, loyalty, and administration.
Around 130 BCE, under Emperor Wu, Confucianism was essentially crowned the state ideology. He established imperial academies and academic chairs specifically for the study of the five classics.
This shift to state orthodoxy initiated a systemic change that is almost impossible to overstate. It led to the creation of the imperial examination system.
We mentioned this in the beginning, but let's look at the mechanics. To get a job in the government bureaucracy, you no longer relied purely on who your father was or how much land you owned.
You had to pass grueling multi-day written exams based entirely on your mastery of the Confucian classics.
It was a massive ideological filter. Every single magistrate, tax collector, and provincial governor in the empire had to spend their entire youth memorizing the Analects, studying the poetry, and writing essays on the moral duty of a Junzi.
Imagine the modern anxiety surrounding the SATs, the bar exam, or the medical boards, but multiply the pressure by 1,000. This exam was the sole mechanism for social mobility.
Entire families would pool their resources to hire tutors for one promising son, hoping he could pass the exams and elevate the entire lineage.
It created a merit-based bureaucracy where political power was achieved through the mastery of moral philosophy.
That system fundamentally shaped Chinese administration, education, literature, and social mobility for 2,000 years, right up until the system was finally abolished in the early 20th century.
The mastery of these ancient texts defined what it meant to be an educated, civilized person in East Asia, which brings us to the ultimate question of legacy. We are talking about a philosophy forged in the iron and blood of the ancient Warring States period, formalized into state orthodoxy over 2 millennia ago. How does this ancient system function today?
Its influence is still deeply embedded in the cultural DNA of East Asian societies, present-day China, South Korea, Japan, Vietnam, and Singapore.
Right.
While the formal imperial exams are gone, the underlying values continue to drive attitudes toward education, respect for elders and authority, and the fundamental value placed on social cohesion and the collective good over stark Western-style individualism.
We even see it operating explicitly in contemporary business ethics. The sources point out the relevance of the Confucian principle of reciprocity functioning within modern capitalism.
It is the idea that long-term business relationships should be built on mutual obligation, trust, and ethical dealing, rather than purely transactional, cutthroat profit-seeking.
The concept of Xun trustworthiness and reliability remains a vital currency in East Asian business networks. You do not just sign a contract, you build a relationship based on reciprocal obligation.
However, it is important to note that the legacy of Confucianism is also the subject of intense ongoing debate and criticism globally.
We need to address those critiques. Our goal here is to impartially report on the perspectives provided in our sources, examining how the philosophy is analyzed by modern sociologists and political scientists.
On one hand, you have significant political and social criticisms. Critics argue that the strict hierarchical structures embedded in the five relationships ruler over subject, father over son, husband over wife, inherently entrench authoritarianism.
They argue that historically, without aggressive egalitarian reforms, these principles have been weaponized by those in power.
Right. To justify oppressive patriarchal systems, enforce rigid gender roles, and demand unquestioning obedience to the state, effectively stifling individual liberty and silencing dissent.
It is a framework that, if the superior party ignores the requirement of benevolence, can easily be used to maintain absolute control over the inferior party.
But on the other hand, the sources also point to empirical sociological data suggesting a very different outcome when the system functions as intended. Defenders of the tradition argue that these exact same hierarchical structures and family bonds foster profound social stability.
They point to the measurable outcomes in heavily Confucian-influenced societies: significantly lower crime rates, strong multi-generational family support networks that care for the elderly, exceptionally high educational achievement, and a pervasive sense of collective responsibility.
Responsibility that prevents the social fragmentation, loneliness, and alienation often seen in highly individualistic Western societies.
This raises an important question.
Perhaps the central question of modern political philosophy. How do you weigh the balance between individual freedom and communal harmony?
Confucianism clearly prioritizes the health of the community and the stability of the family unit over the absolute autonomy of the individual.
It is a framework that constantly asks what we owe to each other, rather than just focusing on what our individual rights are. It is a philosophy that demands we look at our social obligations before we look at our personal desires.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener, today? As we wrap up this exploration of Master Kong and his legacy, I want to leave you with a specific, provocative thought to mull over. A concept that builds on the source material we have unpacked over the last hour.
It connects right back to Confucius's fundamental belief about the nature of order. He believed that true governance does not come from a heavy hand or the threat of violence.
If the core thesis of Confucianism is that true order, true societal harmony, can only emerge from personal moral cultivation, from the inner ethical character of the Yunzi, rather than from external laws, punishments, or coercion, what happens to a modern society that operates using the exact opposite mechanism? What happens to a culture that relies almost entirely on an endless web of complex legal contracts, the threat of litigation, and heavily armed police forces to maintain order while actively neglecting the inner ethical character of its citizens? Are we trying to artificially enforce from the outside what can only truly be built from the inside?
Thank you for listening, History Maps. Learn history visually.
Thank you for listening, History Maps. Learn history visually.